Okay.
Let's start cruising 9:30 here. Bio 550, right? And we still have three people that are absent. Maybe they'll join us in a little bit. Riley, you said it's coming?
I think so.
You could always text her and harass her. We harass everybody, and they harass me, so it's all right. Mm-hmm. So what we want to do is to try, today, go through what this course is about and get to know everybody, because what is this course going to be? A discussion-based course, too. We're all going to interact. We're going to think. We're going to turn on our brain juices and think out of the box a bit, away from the textbooks, and I'll tell you why, because sometimes they just don't give you all the information, and try to come up with things that interest you, right? And there might be something that's really, hey, I really want to know more about that, and let's look it up together, okay? Because no one can know everything, and the internet's always right, but sometimes it's wrong, and we have to check it out and make sure, where's the facts, where's the information for it, right? And there's so many interesting things out there on a comparative physiology basis that I think we can all find something really interesting. So hopefully these people will come soon and we can all get together. But let's go through, well, since it's recording and not everybody's here yet, we'll wait for them. Let's go through the syllabus a little bit then here. So just that in case everybody wants to know, it's all posted, right? Did y'all find it somewhere on campus or something like that?
Yeah. It's on the website.
It's on the website.
Everything's on the website.
Everything's on the website. Campus is a nightmare, but anyways. I like the website because I can post stuff, and Canvas sometimes has limitations on what we can post, but I can just put it on the website and get everything together. There's another victim. Who's there?
And that's Julie.
Oh my goodness. Yes, there's Julie. How are you? Here, we're all in a circle thing. See, I remembered your name. All right, so the syllabus, there's all that stuff in there, and what are we doing? We have to have some exams. They tell me I have to have exams. I hate exams. But anyways, we'll have exams. So we get like two exams, the final exam, quizzes, just make sure you're all, brain's still awake and everything. And then there's points, and there's all the good stuff in there. If anybody has DRC information or stuff like that, then you have to send that to me so we can make adjustments. And hopefully we can just schedule times somehow, either at the DRC or here, and get that solved. So I just kind of put this up as a template. We do not have to stick with this schedule. We can move things around, but I just put that up there to give us a jumping start to go with. But you can see the topics. It's generally interesting aspects that would be covered in a comparative physiology course, but hopefully we can cover some things more in depth. And some of these aspects we might spend a lot more time with than others. Hopefully, maybe we can mix in. I put primary papers down here to cover topics that you might be interested in, or maybe you're doing research in, and you want to know more about that. We can all discuss it as a class. We can move some of these on up to any of these topics as well, okay? But to give us some structure, which, is probably good to have, knowing me, we have this textbook that's really good, and it used to be very expensive, so I don't want anybody to buy a textbook. But if you're really into comparative phys, this is a great textbook. It's written by an Australian comparative physiologist, Weathers. It's not just heavy weight-wise, but it's heavy content-wise, very detailed. So what I've done is to copy some chapters out of that. I can't copy the whole book. It's against rules, that kind of thing. But now you can actually buy the book relatively cheap on Amazon or books rental things. But actually, it's not so bad anymore. For price-wise. It's out of print, but it has the historical content of a lot of the original experiments that were done. That's why I like that book so much, and so that's part of that. So you don't have to buy a book here. We're going to work on it together, all right? And what I've done is put some PowerPoints together for us to talk about things. And so, but in the first, we still have two more people. Hopefully they will come. So I thought maybe we'd just get to know everybody. And because we want this as a discussion and, chit-chat, right? And so everybody's had some content before, Bio 152, Bio 350 maybe, right? You remember a Bio 350 nightmare, right? It's okay. Okay. Yes. Carolyn, did you have it with me or did you have it with somebody else?
I don't know. Wait, Bio 350?
Uh-huh.
I might be thinking it now.
Oh, you taking it now?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Oh, you're not in my class, are you?
Wait, 350
or 318? Oh no, 350 is animal phys.
No.
I don't know. Kristen took it with me, right? Julie took it with me. Anybody else take it with me? You took it with me, Lauren. No? Oh, you, yeah, you. You took it with me.
It's been a couple years, but I took it with you.
And you took it with me. And you survived.
Yeah.
And you came back to sign up for another class. Okay.
I like
to
teach
that
stuff.
Okay. Yeah. You
take that.
All right. You're brave. Anyways, okay. Julie can tell you about her wonderful exams. Their open response, fun, maybe. You had fun.
I had a good time in retrospect.
In retrospect, yeah. Looking back at it. Not at the time, but it's all right. So exams are basically open-ended on the content that we're covering. I don't like giving exams, especially for this class. Let's just say everybody's starting off with an A. How about that? If you don't come to class, you don't participate, then it kind of drops, you know. But it should be straightforward. I hope everybody makes an A in here. We are not trying to make a C as a curve or anything like that. I think in these upper level courses, it's more about, you know, you signed up for it because you're interested in the topic. If not, I think it's better than one of the physics classes you might sign up for, right? It should be fun. Okay, so let's go around and kind of get to know everybody. I can break the ice. I'm Robin Cooper. You can call me Rob. We're all on first name basis. Robin, like the bird, you know. All right. And I've been here since a long time. That's why I lost all my hair. 1996, actually. And so 30 years, going on 30 years, taught comparative phys, animal phys, basically every semester since the beginning of this time. And what else did they torture me with? When I first came here, I had to teach 152. That was god-awful. That's 350 students, you know, the beginning class. And then they tortured me with some other intro course, which I didn't enjoy because you spend about one day on neuroscience and then you're on to cardio and then you're on to something else and it's just like you can't cover any content. So hopefully here we can actually dive into it a little bit more in depth on whatever topics we cover and not to cover the whole gamut because there's too much out there, right? All right, and so before that, what happened? I grew up in West Texas and we raised cattle. I worked in the oil fields, paid for my way for college. When you work in the oil fields, you put your butt in a chair when you get to college because you don't want to spend the rest of your life that way doing that because it's hard labor, especially during winter breaks and stuff like that where the ice is blowing on you and you've got grease all over you. And when you get to college, you say, oh no, I really want to study and get through this mess. And I was pre-vet initially, animal sciences. I worked with cattle when I was young and worked with veterinarians, and I thought that would be really cool. And then went to college, Texas Tech, animal science major, which was a great program. And here it's probably better than it was at Texas Tech. And I'm sure it was. But back in those days, we had to go through all the different labs, the meat labs, cut up cows, you know, get the right meat, different divisions, take animal reproduction, judge like the sheep and the cows, you know, we had to pinch them. Well, I did all that in high school, the 4-H and, you know, ag programs. I thought, wow, I've already done all this. I don't want to do this again. And then I asked some questions for the teacher in animal science class that we had, the beginning animal science class. He said, well, if you really want to know those details, you should go over to the biology department. So I transferred over to the biology department. Took classes over there. Then asked some teachers about topics that we were covering in biology, and they said, well, if you really want to know that, you should, you know, take some chemistry class. So then I switched over to chemistry major. And that was the limit of that, because that was rigorous enough. And so I really found a really good mentor when I was an undergraduate, and we didn't, if you were a BS chemistry major, you had to do a senior thesis and you had to work in a lab. So that's why there was a lot of BA chemistry majors, and there was only 10 of us in the BS chemistry program. And, but it was really fun because you got to know everybody really well, partied together. Back then it was 18 for drinking age, so that was a different, not that I promote drinking, but anyways, different to relax, do things. And then worked in a lab when I was an undergraduate over at the med school to help make money, and then where you had to pull electrodes and kill rabbits, cut out their hearts, get cells in a culture dish, and for the postdocs that were actually going to be doing research afterwards. So, you know, 5 o'clock in the morning, you're trekking over to med school, which wasn't too far away, and then did that research. And then I found a teacher that came to campus to teach this first course in neuroscience. He was really cool because he bridged chemistry, biology, psychology, and it was so interesting. It was the first time a textbook came out in just neuroscience, principles of neuroscience. And he saw that I was working over in the biochemistry department over in the med school. He said, well, if you're interested in more of this topic, you could work in my lab. I'll, you know, hire you in. And then he convinced me to go to graduate school, actually, in physiology. I was really interested in going into, at that time, in chemistry. This is way before CSI and all that stuff that came on TV. The chemists were actually recruited a lot by the FBI group in Texas, because that's their headquarters in Dallas, Texas, for the CSI stuff. And that job pay was pretty good. You think, hey, right out of college, get all this paid back in no time. And it was really fun because it was integrative. And then, but then this other topic looked pretty good, you know, in physiology, and then that pay wasn't so bad. You know, it was a pretty cool teacher at the time. We were recording cat brains inside their brains with electrodes. And I thought, wow, you can record neurons in a white cat. But then I realized that was not the best research project. But anyways, that was a little bit weird. Anyways, long story short, finished the PhD in physiology at the med school, and got through that, survived it somehow. And then for postdocs, it was really quite interesting. You get into something and you really find out what you're interested in. You might not, you know, I changed majors, what, 3 times as an undergraduate. When I was an undergraduate, finally the advisor, back then we had to go to advisors. We didn't have all this web stuff online. You didn't really understand if you were going to graduate or not back then. And then you go your last semester and they say, you just need one more course and you can get your double major, like in a BS in biology and a BS in zoology. It was god-awful. The one course they suggested was genetics. Sorry. That was the worst course ever for me at that time, because I think genetics was just created at that year. You know, DNA was discovered. But then thinking about postdocs, and this is what I want to, I'm going to send you all emails. You're going to be on my email list forever, and you're going to get lots of emails, so just put me on spam right away if you want to. Applying for summer programs. Really good to do this, or maybe research experiences. So there's things called REUs, I don't know if you heard of it, Research for Undergraduate, you know, universities and stuff. They have programs, sometimes in ecology, sometimes in physiology, even in genetics, but anyways, if you like that. So those are really good, and that's usually throughout the U.S. There are marine biology labs, in research labs, that have courses in the summer that you could apply for. I applied for it every year when I was in graduate school to this one course that I really thought was so cool. It was a neurobiology course at Woods Hole Marine Biological Laboratory, which is our oldest marine biology station in the U.S. But they're all over. And they're not just on marine biology. They might be hardcore cell biology or bioinformatics or, you know, maybe a marine biology course or ecology. And usually if you're accepted to those programs, they're for undergraduates also, in graduate students. You just have to look at which course you're applying to. They usually have a fellowship for you, and they will pay you when you're there in the summer. They don't say it upfront, but they list their scholarships for that. There's so much endowment money for a lot of these programs because the people that have taken it realize that was a big stepping stone for them, and they have a lot of progression from these courses. So they donate back to it. I still donate to Woods Hole Marine Biological Laboratory because it's just fantastic place. And there's places at Friday Harbor, California, Bodega Marine Lab is part of Stanford. So I'm going to send you these emails. You can, you know, delete them as you like, whatever. But if you don't apply, you'll never know. And they're just great. They usually have world experts that come in and, you know, go to teach at these places. So long story short, I applied for postdocs. And, of course, my PhD advisor at that time. So you go to a PhD and stuff like that, and you're in a lab, and then you think, what are you going to do with after that? You know, go teach somewhere, or maybe do research. But to do a research, you really have to go on and do, like, a postdoc, which is after a PhD. It's like a residency in med school. And then you focus in on a narrow topic. But then you got to think, well, which lab do you want to apply to, where, and all that kind of stuff. So it's just like residencies for if you're interested in med school, you know, like, which one are you going to get into? There's limits for all these because they have to pay you money and all that kind of good stuff. So I was stupid enough to think this textbook that I really loved when I was in grad school, called Neuron to Brain by John Nichols, which was translated into like 7 different languages or so. And it was just a fantastic book because he explained neurobiology really simply, the old experiments that were done in the 50s, all these Nobel laureates and stuff. And then, you know, you look at his background, it was like fantastic. He worked with Bernard Katz, which got the Nobel Prize and all this kind of good stuff in synaptic transmission. I love the synaptic transmission aspect. And then, so I thought, well, I'll just write to him, you know, see what happens. Who knows? My PhD advisor said, oh boy, you are. You're really trying for this, aren't you? Because I tried MPL every summer and he had to write rec letters, you know, and he's probably like, I got another rec letter. Okay. I don't mind rec letters for you all either, so that's okay. If you're needing to apply to something, are these programs, glad to write them for you. And I pass them off to you ahead of time to make little tweaks or whatever you want. And so he said, yeah, go for it. Okay, we'll see what happens. And then one day I was in the lab and he said, Cooper, not you, Cooper, my Cooper. you got a phone call on the phone. This is like before email, you know, people had to make calls or write letters because I had to write a letter, put a stamp on it and went overseas and you think I probably got lost, boat somewhere. Anyways, he said, John Nichols is on the phone. He wants to talk to you. And he said, I guess he got your letter. I said, oh, God. Okay, so we're talking, and he said, and he was in Switzerland at the time, he said, so are you going to this meeting, this neuroscience meeting? And I said, well, I could, yes, I'll go. Yeah, I'm going to this meeting, yes. Because he said, well, we could interview you at this meeting. So you never know what's happening, right? So go to this meeting, and he said, meet at this into this row, he has his publisher, he signs his book. You know, and I thought, well, I read your book, and of course that was in the letter, and maybe I inflated his ego by reading his book and telling it was the best thing ever. And who knows? And I said, okay. And he said, we'll be there, you know, at this time and all this stuff. So, okay, all right. So you go to the meeting, you're out all this money, you go to the meeting, everything's expensive. I still remember that. And I actually had to put a loan on my motorcycle at that time to get the money to do this. Anyways, so go to this meeting, and then I'm sitting there, go early, but then I saw this poster. There's a line of posters at these meetings. Like Society for Neuroscience is 30,000 people nowadays. It's a 5-day meeting. It's fantastic if you ever go to these meetings, and it's really good. But I saw this poster at the end of this hallway that's by all these publishers, and it was on regeneration in crab legs, which is really cool. And if you don't know, T.H. Morgan, his first research was on regeneration of what? Crab legs. I didn't know that until I came here. It was wild. Anyways, so I was interested in how nerves regenerate and all that, sensory nerves and motor nerves and all that stuff. And here was this poster where this guy was presenting, and I read his work in grad school. I thought, this is really cool, so let's go up and talk to him. And guess where he worked at? MBL, Marine Biological Laboratory. I was like, he works at MBL. This is really, really cool. And, you know, because I was applying every summer to get in this program, I was rejected, you know, because there's like 10 people for the course. It's insane. Anyways, so I talked to him about his work and said, well, are you doing this and that? And, you know, about these different asymmetry claws that are in lobsters and crabs, you know, a crusher and a cutter. If you ever go to Kroger, check out the lobsters in their tank. Anyways, he said, well, are you interested in doing that research? And I said, yeah, really, that's really cool. He said, well, if you want to do that, I have a spot open in the summer at MBL, and you could work in the lab. I was like, huh, is this alive? You know, you got to pinch yourself. And then I said, well, I, you know, just got married and everything. He said, oh, yeah, well, bring your wife along. I'll pay for your housing and everything and transport, and you just come. But one condition, that you will stay the full 4 months to, you know, work in the lab and get something done, because you really have to spend the whole time. And it's very expensive to have a lab at MBL. I mean, maybe even half of this room at that time was $5,000 a month to rent that space, because it's so highly utilized. It's hard to get research space there. But he had been working there for years. And then all of a sudden, I'm talking to this guy, and then somebody comes behind us and said, oh, hi, CK. You know, this was this guy's name. And I was supposed to meet this bloke that was supposed to be here, you know, waiting for me, but he didn't show up. And I'm trying, that's John Nichols. I completely forgot what was happening. And so they knew each other. You realize it's a very small world out there and the people that know each other and things. And then I said, oh, that's me, sorry. And he said, well, you know, we're supposed to sit over here and talk. And I said, okay, we'll go talk. And so already I'm just like, he said, so are you going to come to MBL, you know, this summer? I, yeah, sure. Okay, no problem. And he said, well, you can't make those commitments until we talk, you know, and stuff. And so then we sat down and talking to this guy that was like, you know, really good. And he said, well, what do you want to do? And so I, why are you applying to my lab and all this good stuff? And I told him, oh, well, I read your papers. Back then we had to go to the library, actually, get a journal, copy it, read it. It wasn't, you know, on the internet. And of course you had your notes and things. And he said, well, so what are you interested in doing? And I so told him my project that I thought, if you're doing this work. And he said, well, yeah, we're kind of interested in that, but I had something else in mind. But if you're interested in doing that, you know, project, and you really, it looks like you've got it all lined out what you want to do, okay. He didn't even ask for a rec letter. He didn't ask for a resume. He didn't, you know, I sent him what I did, and he knew you graduated, you know, and stuff. And but what is the interest here? What I'm trying to tell you is what's going to succeed in life is passion. If you really like what you're doing, you're going to have that passion, and you're going to excel at it, right? But if it's just kind of vanilla, what are the new kids? I was just at a middle school the other day, and their presentation said, well, my presentation's a 6'7", and I had to ask the teacher, what's a 6'7"? So now I know what 6'7" is, but his presentation was pretty good. Anyways, so it's, you know, not that 6'7", not the average thing. You really got to go all out, right? So after talking with John Nichols, and he was a professor at Harvard, then he moved to Stanford. He also taught at Yale, and then he got this chairmanship job at the University of Basel in Switzerland. So he was well known. And then he said, you know, I just finished interviewing a whole bunch of other people, and they couldn't tell me a project that they were interested in. And these were, he said, and this kid, you know, used to work where I used to work at you know, at Harvard. And he's brain dead. And so I'm just like, oh, good God, you know, okay. He said, so if you really want to do that, one condition, that you come and work with me for 4 years in Switzerland, in Basel, and work on this project. And maybe we can have some other projects parallel. And I was just like, are you serious? Okay, that sounds great. Okay, so that's really good. But you see, the point is, understanding what you're doing and what you want to do and passion and relay that information. So the same thing on your resumes, if you're applying to med school or other programs, how do you present yourself here or where you want to be to go? So I was talking to somebody that interviews over here at UK, been here 30 years, we have lots of rec letters and no people, and they said, well, we just interviewed this other kid, and I see your rec letter too, and but the kid's really good, you know, straight A's and everything else, but there's no passion. You know, you interview this kid and there's just no passion. He doesn't really know why he wants to go into medicine, help people. And then, you know, he asked him, well, if you want to help people, go into nursing and you could help people 24/7, you know. And he couldn't answer why he wanted to go into medicine. So the interview's over, you know, basically, right? So these are the things I'm trying to relay to you too. Really show what you're interested in. And there's a lot of dissatisfaction with physicians that get out of medical school later on. They interview these people 10 years after and they said they'd rather have done something else. They don't realize the amount of work, paperwork, liabilities, all this kind of stuff with it. So you have to understand what you're interested in. Anyway, so I called my wife after that and she was back in Texas. And I said, guess what? We're moving to Woods Hole this summer in about 2 weeks. And then we're moving to Switzerland for, you know, the next 4 years. And she said, have you been drinking with your buddies again? You know, so you never know. And then after that, and another meeting came up. I was interested in getting back to the States. You know, you have to get a job sometime, right? Can't be a postdoc forever. And then went to another neuroscience meeting and wrote to this person ahead of time. We met at a hot dog stand. He said, well, let's go meet and have lunch. But lunch lines are too long. And we got to go to the meeting and go to the posters. And he said, well, let's just get a hot dog. Okay. So we're sitting on steps at this convention place because it's so busy and you can't get a seat. And we're having a hot dog together. And he says, so what are you interested in? What do you want to do? You know, why do you want to work in the lab? And so I talked to him. And this is Harold Atwood. He was in Toronto, Canada. Margaret Atwood's brother, actually, unless you read Margaret Atwood's books and stuff. And he is like number one researcher in Canada. I was like, oh, hell, you know, hell no. He's not going to take me in a heartbeat, right? Number one in his grants, number one in the research and everything, and I just thought, oh, damn, okay. I think he had his sister help write grants or something, but, you know, he's a good writer. Anyways, he said, so you want to do this kind of project and work on these? This is kind of a new thing with Drosophila, working at neuromuscular junctions, and I said, yeah, if I can work on that thing, and my little PowerPoint went off, and he said, yeah, okay, if you want to work on that, I have kind of a condition, at least 3 years and we'll apply for a fourth year fellowship for you. And I was just like, oh God, okay, this is fantastic. So you see what happens? And then you apply to places and you get a job somewhere, right? So this is where I came then, 96 here. The point I'm trying to make, passion, show what you're really interested in and then go for it. And don't worry about where or anything else. We've had students that apply to Cleveland Clinic, Mayo Clinic, and they get in. Right now, it was really cool. Some of these students that first gen, he's really good, Clay Turner. And he worked in my lab as a high school student, undergraduate, and he wasn't sure about med school. He was a music major plus a biology major, and he talks about this openly. And he came through UK, last minute, you know, alternate list the day before the white coat ceremony, actually pulled him in. And so, because somebody else didn't make it. And he, where is he now? Harvard Med School teaching neurology, okay? What did he do there? He was fantastic. You know, he's where he still is. And we had another undergraduate years later that came through the lab. He wasn't really sure where he could go. He went to Cleveland Clinic, med school up there. And then he applied to neurology. I said, well, just go for it. You know, apply anywhere, everywhere. We're recruiters for you. And guess who he interviewed with? Clay Turner, that was at Harvard in the med school program. And they talked about their work on crayfish trips. So you never know where it goes, right? Networking is really important. That's what I'm telling you about, too. Going to meetings, getting out there, building your resume. Okay. I've chatted enough. Let's go with it and just kind of go around and chit-chat. Who are you? What's your major? What do you want to get out of it? What's interesting to you? Go for it.
Okay, I guess I'm first. I'm Kendall. My major is neuroscience. As far as like what I want to get out of it, I want to be a brain surgeon, so.
Good. Another, Sanjay Gupta, right?
Yeah.
he's always, you know, talking about neurosurgery. Great.
Hi, my name is Max. I'm actually a master's student here in the Department of Biology. Actually going kind of through a little pivotal change. I had applied to med school. Didn't know if it was something I wanted to do, actually. And so I wanted to come back, and I'm actually looking to try and get a PhD. But just right now, building up some connections, seeing where I would want to go and apply and things like that. So actually kind of going through some stuff, just seeing what's out there, and so having some fun with that.
That's good.
Hi, my name is Hannah. I did my bachelor's in animal and veterinary science at Eastern UKU. Started this August as a master's student in the animal science department. My focus is in ruminant nutrition. In simple terms, I study beef cattle and and I absolutely love it. I'm not really for sure if I want to continue with my PhD or not. That was the initial goal all along, but I really like extension and talking with producers and things like that. And agriculture has my heart in animal science.
Okay. Good. And that's what got me interested in veterinarian too. I was really stupid when I was a young kid in high school. We had cattle. And we had young alfalfa that just grew in the cows love that. Open the gate and let them eat. And they get bloated on this early alfalfa. So, and they can't poop and they, you know, can't belch because they're too much bloated. So we had to call the vet because they were, all these cows are in pain. And these, you crazy kid, you can't do that to, you know, young alfalfa and young, all this stuff. So he takes this big old needle, one of the things like that big in diameter, sticks it right through the cow's side to let all the gas out. And I was like, it was really traumatic. But he said, well, you want to work with me and learn about how to really take care of cows? Then, you know, so I worked with a large animal vet, and that's why I was interested in vet sciences.
So, like, I have a veterinary background, but I want to study nutritional disease, mm-hmm. and my current study is related to bloat.
Bloat. See, even one of those stupid high school kids, you know, don't know what they're doing. Shouldn't have cows.
I'm Cooper.
Yeah.
Not Dr. Cooper.
Yep. No, Cooper.
I'm a master's student as well here. I'm in the MAT in secondary STEM education, and I am going to go into biology, so I'll be a biology high school teacher, hopefully.
That's fantastic.
And so my undergrad study was at the University of Colorado Boulder. Today's actually my first day of classes at UK. This is my very first class here.
Wow.
So I just started.
It's the best class ever. You'll mind this.
Yeah. And, I have background in physiology, decided I wanted to branch that into teaching. I really, really enjoy working with people. I actually started as a personal trainer and realized that I really liked instruction and relationship aspect of it. So then I took that passion and decided, you know, maybe I should get into teaching. And the biggest thing is, again, kind of similar messages to what Dr. Cooper says, helping people find their passion, get excited about life, that kind of thing.
Good. Maybe you can coach us for exercise. Okay.
I'm Caroline. I'm a senior studying neuroscience, and I want to be a PA.
All right. Fantastic.
I'm Kristen. I'm also a senior studying neuroscience, and I'm also on a pre-PA track, too.
Wow. So that's why you're together.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm Morgan. I'm a junior studying neuroscience, and I'm also on a
pre-PA track. I'm seeing a pattern.
Okay. We got that four.
I'm Laura. I'm a psych major, and I'm on the track, and I have a minor in neuroscience, cognitive science, and philosophy. And I want to go to med school and study psychiatry.
Oh, wonderful. Mm-hmm. You can start on us trying to figure us out.
I'm Lauren, and I am a senior biology student on the pre-med track.
Mm, all right, great.
I'm Andrew. I just graduated from last year. So right now I'm a postdoc fellow working in a cardiovascular lab in the BBSRB, and I'm applying for med school this year.
Great. Whose lab are you in?
Shavar Blair.
Oh, Shavar is fantastic.
Two summers of research in Dr. Kumulski's lab and undergrad doing a scholars program.
Great. We're trying to get Shavar to ride bikes with us. He wants to go riding long distances.
He works out all the time.
I know, he's like super strong, but we got to get him on a bike to run, not just lifting weights.
Okay. My name is Julia. I'm a senior bio major, and I'm also applying to medical school this year.
So. Great. All right. And we want to hear these successes when you get into PA, med school, so we can all celebrate. Maybe bring in food. I love food, candy. We'll try to bring it. I have to save this candy that I brought for seminar because I promised them candy today. Anyways, I can make up stories about Madison and Riley, but I probably should stay from recording this. But anyways, hopefully it'll join us in time. Okay, so what do we want to cover? We want to cover really good things. Also, hopefully content that you can bring into the classroom or work on related towards research or whatever you're interested in. Or maybe PA, dental school is interesting too. Comparative aspect on dentation might be interesting, who knows? Okay. So let's just kind of hit some general aspects. So you all had some physiology background before, some Bio350s, ITES, some that you might be in together. Did you figure out if you're concurrently taking it or did you already have it?
No, I have to take it like on my gap year.
Okay, good. Okay. Somehow we, okay. But you had 152, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you remember like tissues and things like that. Okay, I'm just joking. All right, so what is it that we really want to get at? So I kind of like cross, you know, structure, what are we talking about? And, you know, constant stress, I don't want you to have stress, but we could just think about any topic that you might get in the news. I think a lot of people are probably stressed right now. Every time I turn on the news, it's stressful. But anyways, what happens with constant stress? Any ideas? Like, what happens to the body? Yeah.
Your body goes into like fight or flight.
Mm-hmm, fight or flight. And then more details, what happens in fight or flight? Anybody?
Cortisol
levels. Is that good for us or bad for us? Constantly bad. Why might it be bad? Anybody have an idea why cortisol? What does cortisol do?
Reduces blood sugar, right?
Would it reduce it or?
Oh, no, increase.
Increase it to get ready for stress for the day, right? Mm-hmm. So our cortisol levels go up early morning, like you probably rose this morning thinking about, I got to get out of bed. I got to get up and function. So even before you feet hit the floor, your cortisol levels go up in the morning if you're on a normal week sleep wake cycle, so your glucose levels go up so you can handle the stress of the day, right? Okay. But what would happen if it was constant, do you think?
Doesn't it make us age faster? I've read stuff about that.
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah.
And you know, the internet's always right, but no, I'm joking. No, I'm just joking. All right, you have to, you know, be sarcastic back, it's okay. All right, so it is stressful, and it is kind of problems that it also helps, and you think about people that take cortisol injections all the time, they actually have bone atrophy. Their bones weaken too from this. It's really something. So people that are asthmatics, for example, will take cortisol quite often, injections, and they actually then break their bones easier. And these are really weird things, but you wonder, what's the mechanism behind that? So everything that we want to cover is mechanistic. What's the mechanism behind it? How's it working at the cell level? And, you know, what's really going on? So that's the kind of things that we want to cover in here. So any topic that you pick, you know, you can just dive it in on physiology and think about what else does it do for you. Constant stress, they've looked at animals at zoos, for example, and you know, you see the parrot raising its head up and down all the time in a little parrot cage. That's supposed to be a stressful behavior. And if you measure their cytokines, which is an inflammatory response, those are increased, but they don't have inflammation, but it's this constant stress. And then cytokines aren't good for us. They cause arrhythmias, for example, in the heart. They can cause the blood-brain barrier to break down, and then you know get even worse conditions. So that constant stress isn't good. And so this is why they changed the zoo structure. They finally realized. There was a guy at Stanford that studied stress in zoo animals and found out, oh, we give them bigger cages, we give them more things to play with, we give them, you know, tactile things and stuff like that. And then their stress levels went down, they're healthier. So yeah, long-term stress isn't good in so many ways, right? So it's good. So those are the kind of things we want to think about, all right? Brain juices, really going. So that's, and then, you know, constant stress, you can think constant joy too. That's not maybe all good too, like we're kind of artificially always saying, hey, we're happy, but maybe down deep we're not really happy. But, you know, there's things like dopamine, endorphin release if you're exercising all the time, right? And if you don't exercise, what happens if you're a runner? And then the next day, it's a cold day and you don't want to run.
Sometimes.
Pardon?
So high endorphin release can be runner's high.
Yeah. Can you tell us about endorphin and runner's high or anything about that?
Not too much. I know more about cortisol.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So. But I do know that in terms of cortisol, exercise can actually increase your good stress and cortisol and actually grow the right side, hypertrophy of the right side of the adrenal glands, which is interesting, and actually the left side will shrink down a little bit. That's really interesting because the good stress actually helps our health and is shown to have good health outcomes. So exercise can increase good cortisol, which then can help with increased health.
Good glucose, and you can work, right? So that's good. And then you hear of bodybuilders, and not you, but you know, other bodybuilders, that keep injections like Lance Armstrong did the year through Poietin, right? Which raises your red blood cell count so you can have more oxygen. I started swimming recently this summer because of a god-awful adventure that I had. I thought I could do a triathlon. I signed up for a triathlon because I can run and bike, no problem. And then the swimming thing was like, it's okay, you float and you swim, you know? Okay. It's not a good idea. I did this in Miami, Oxford, Ohio. There's a lake up there. Started off swimming, you know, going for it. Everybody else is taking off. I'm thinking, oh my God, these people are like mermaids or something. And, you know, the guy's splashing on top of me, and I'm going up for a breath, and I get water in my mouth, and I'm just like, choking. It's lake water. It's horrible. And I had a panic attack that was horrible. I just like, I can't breathe. I'm in the middle of a lake. I can't touch the bottom. I don't see the bottom. And I remember what they said at the very beginning, just swim to the shore if you have a panic attack. And I thought, this guy's crazy. Who's going to have a panic attack? Well, I found out that could happen. And that was a severe panic attack. So I swam to the shore as fast as I could. And these are stories that you can bring into. My cortisol levels were probably out the skyrocket, and my whole body was sympathetic. And I was swimming so hard because I just saw the shore. Well, first of all, this panic attack, and then I thought I was getting a leg cramp, which I hate. These things are horrible, especially open water. You can't touch the bottom. And then it was all panicky. And then I raised my hand because someone's in a kayak over there that's supposed to be, you know, watching you. So if they go down, they know where your body is, I think. But I couldn't see that they saw me because I didn't have prescription goggles on, and I can't see that far. So I'm waving my hand, but I think the person's not seeing it. I'm thinking, oh, God, I'm going to die. So I just swam to the shore as fast as I could. I don't think I breathed the whole time. And then finally, my arms were actually hitting the dirt because I'm going up on the shore because I was just swimming so fast. And the guy said, we have to disqualify you because you didn't quite finish the swim. I said, all power to you. But you can still run and, you know, bike. And so I did that. It took me 2 miles of biking. You transition, you get out of your swimsuit and you, it's a biking little pant thing with sponges on the bottom so your butt's not too sore. But then it took me like 2 miles of biking this 10-mile thing before my heart rate finally came down. I mean, that was a real panic attack. And then I thought, this cortisol? Whew. So that was a sympathetic response that was massive. I don't know if you ever had that, but it's really, really bad. Anyways, some people take injections of cortisol, and just like you said, your adrenal glands say, okay, if you're making it from your adrenal gland, what does anybody remember what part of your adrenal gland? You have the adrenal medulla, and you have the adrenal cortex. Which one?
The cortex.
Glucocorticoids, right? And then the adrenal medulla does norepinephrine, epinephrine, like the sympathetic response. So good. So if you keep it taking injections to maybe raise your glucose, what's going to happen to your natural production of cortisol? It starts to drop because your cells say, I'm getting enough cortisol, and they start to atrophy if you're injecting. Not a good thing to be injecting these things, right? And then you quit injecting because you feel good enough. And then how is your adrenal gland now? It's so small. So when you have a stressful event, you can't produce the cortisol that you need. So this is kind of the physiology that we want to talk about as well, things like this, okay? And your runner's high, the norepinephrine, endorphins, right? What is endorphins? Endogenous morphine, right? So morphine, you know, make you feel good, don't inject it. But your endogenous levels would increase and make you feel good all the time, right? But you don't want it all the time, because then you're probably on some drugs, right? And that's not good for you, right? So this is part of it as well. So we want to understand this balance. So what are we talking about then? Homeostasis, which is the PDF that I sent you about homeostasis, right? So let's think about homeostasis in a little bit and things like that. Key to it all is really at the cell level, right? The cell level. So I've got these little PowerPoints. Homeostasis, and you know, and this is all on your website too, all these cool things. So I'm going to copy some things down. So just to kind of get to know, look at way back when, you know, they were thinking about this 1929 by Cannon, and just phenomenal history and understanding how the body functions. Okay, and then we want to get into like, what is homeostasis? How do you regulate homeostasis? So think about anything. You're running. You're late to class. No, I'm just joking. And you're running, and then you come to class, and you sit down, and you're still breathing fast. Why are we still breathing fast, even though we're not exercising anymore?
Because your levels are
still high.
Because
your what? Your
levels are still increased.
Of what? Levels of what? Cortisol. Cortisol, probably, but how does that make you breathe faster? All that, yeah, that's good stuff. And that it's all part of it. But what's the mechanism that makes that happen? You're exercising. Now, I want you to bring it down to the cell level. What's happening at the cell level?
Oxidation.
Oxidation. What do you have as a byproduct? Anybody want that tattoo? Did you get that tattoo yet? I suggest everybody in 350 to get that tattoo.
It makes CO2.
Yes, CO2. You know what happens? C6, H12, O6, plus what? 6 waters gives 6 CO2s. No, 6 oxygens gives 6 CO2s as a byproduct, plus water, right? And that's a metabolic water. So you actually make water, right, as a byproduct. And then heat and ATP, right? So that's the whole thing. Great tattoos, better than that butterfly tattoo that you might get. All right. So what happens with that? That's at a cell level. So at the cell level, you're exercising, your muscles are going, you're getting this metabolism, you get a byproduct. How does that trigger increased heart rate? How does that trigger, or just a thought that you're running behind, so your brain is like, I gotta go, so your brain's triggering some of this and hormones, but at a cell level, then why are you breathing faster? Now I finally sit, but I'm still breathing faster from running. It'd be like me late in class, probably.
You need more oxygen because of it, and so you start to, and your blood's getting more acidic, right? Because you have more CO2, and so you need to breathe out faster so that you get the CO2 out.
Right. So you want to get that CO2 out, and you don't just have the CO2 in your body, right? At the cell level, the byproduct, that CO2, it's converted very fast to bicarb in your red blood cell. So it's converted to bicarb by carbonic anhydrase, which is a very fast enzyme. So it's converted to bicarb. Most of your CO2 is converted to bicarb, transported in the blood, goes up to your lungs, hits the epithelial tissue in your lung, and then you have that enzyme again. And enzymes can work both directions. And then it's converted to bicarb back to CO2 so you can blow it out, like you said. But in the meantime, let's think of that reaction. Water. Let me write it on the board so we all know what's going on. Water. I think that's still right. Water plus CO2 goes, makes what? H2CO3. Well, that could be pluses if you want, but if it disassociates. And then that's H plus bicarb, right? So just in the water alone, water, CO2, makes hydrogen ions, bicarbs. So we, you know, here's your hydrogen ion, right? So this is where your pH drops. But also, if you're exercising, like you said, your oxygen levels drop, right? So your body, sometimes you think about oxygen debt. A lot of textbooks just say oxygen debt. You want to pay back the oxygen debt. But there's more to it than just that. Your pH is possibly dropped. And this is what happens in your skeletal muscles, right there locally. You make the CO2, the bicarb, the CO2 is going across to the red blood cell, converting to bicarb. Bicarb is being transported, but you also just lower the pH. And that's kind of good in this exercising skeletal muscle, because if you remember, hemoglobin and PO2, partial pressure of, well, let's do this, percent saturation of your hemoglobin, right? And if we think about the curve, which is really a sigmoidal curve, right? A sigmoidal curve. For getting up to 100% oxygen saturation of your hemoglobin, think about what's happening here. Is if you want more saturation quicker, this is actually, if you drop pH, your hemoglobin can be saturated better. It promotes the oxygen, no, I got it backwards, correct? Yell at me when I get this backwards. It's just the other way around. I have up pH, that's it. It decreases oxygen saturation. What's this called? The Bohr effect, right? For those studying for MCAT. It decreases oxygen saturation at the same level of PO2, partial pressure of oxygen, so it decreases the saturation, so it unloads oxygen from hemoglobin, which is good because you want the oxygen to go into your skeletal muscle, right? So it comes off your hemoglobin and goes into your skeletal muscle. So it's good, but at the same time, the pH is dropped in your blood. So now we have the oxygen content which dropped in your blood because you're using it up. And what detects oxygen content in your body? Where do you sense that? Do they cause you to breathe faster? Anybody have an idea?
Is it the medulla oblongata or no?
Yeah, part of it. Do you have generally a couple places that are really sensitive to this? The carotid. Oh my gosh, I forgot. It's the carotid bodies or the carotid sinuses. There's a multiple choice test in my MCAT. I can't remember if it's carotid bodies or carotid sinuses. Remember how we remember that? Sinuses in your head. When you have a sinus headache, what do you feel?
Pressure.
Carotid sinuses detect your blood pressure. Carotid bodies detect your pH and O2 levels, okay? So this is a way to remember that. So sinuses, pressure. And then you have aortic bodies that also can detect your PO2 and pH levels. And do you know what? Those things in your carotid bodies, it's so wild. The cells, they still don't understand how they function completely about sensing pH, or CO2 they sense, what it, our oxygen itself that they sense. So now they think it's a little bit of everything. It's amazing. So there's a guy up at Wright State, Dayton, Ohio, that was a world expert in this. What did he study to figure it out? A lot of it? Turtles. Diving turtles. Because a turtle can dive for so long, and their pH can go way down, their lactic acid builds up, and they can handle hypoxia, low oxygen, and somehow not needing right away to surface like we would if we're swimming, you know, and holding our breath, right? So there must be something really different about them. So he studied diving turtles that stay down a long time to understand more about those cell processes. So it's really cool. So we're going to cover things like this. The point about homeostasis then think about, we need to be in a range. So we're trying to get back into that range again. So we want to think about, how does pH affect your breathing? So I'll send you a little thing that we made for 350 a while back about how does your carotid bodies sense hydrogen ion and oxygen. So it's really, some textbooks were saying it's more hydrogen ion, some more oxygen. So it's a little bit of both nowadays. And what they found out, these are really cool. These are cells that detect that and then release like neurotransmitters. They think dopamine, acetylcholine, other things that sensory neurons then right there next to it, sensory neurons next to it, pick it up, and then they go to your brain and fire, say, oh, you need to increase your breathing rate. So they go to this region in your brainstem called the nucleus tractus solitarius, and they actually tell those neurons, say, you got to breathe faster, and then they go and cause you to breathe faster. And then there's places in your, in the brain, where you have these two ventricles, left and lateral ventricles, and then it goes to a third ventricle, and then there's a fourth ventricle, and then that cerebral spinal fluid goes around your brainstem and around your brain. In that fourth ventricle, it's right above your brainstem. That CSF fluid, actually, the cells right there can detect the pH and CO2. And they don't completely understand, is it really just pH, or is it the CO2 that can go in? Because CO2 is can go right through biolipid membranes, right? So it can go right into the cell. And how does it know that? Same with oxygen, gases can go right through the cells. So then maybe those neurons in there are acting like our carotid bodies, right? And detecting this and actually increasing their firing rate as well. So there's different regions in our body that can detect this. So pretty important, right? Because we want to breathe right. But why is it that we have to keep our pH so in a narrow level where a diving turtle can lower it way down and they don't have cell damage, right? And even whales can drop it down really deeply. They've looked at these, they're not really whales, right? The orcas that are in like SeaWorld and things like that and did blood samples when they're down and all these kind of good things. And they see like diving birds and others, they can handle this level, but we couldn't handle that. We'd pass out at the pH level. So what's so different about them? So these are the things that we might find interesting to read about, more details, okay? So this is, I'm just trying to get your brain juices going and interesting topics. Wherever you can go, you can take it at every level. But all this happens at the cell level. So pH, I bring this up in 350. pH, I just want some of these topics that we kind of understand too. What's pH? pH, you remember this crazy story? We'll let them not answer, maybe others. pH equals, and we teach high school science teachers too, so this is a concept that's interesting. We teach those in the summer programs. I don't know if you signed up for any of those things or not. So some of the problems are, and even our freshman classes here sometimes don't teach it fully. pH is acid-base levels, right? Neutral is 7, right? Does pH change with temperature? Maybe, maybe not, maybe. How many would think, yes, it changes with temperature. No, it doesn't change with temperature. And then, you know, my third answer, I don't care, I don't know. what? Anybody have an idea? Does pH change with temperature? What's the equation for pH? pH? Negative longer than hydrogen ion concentration, right? So if we have more hydrogen ions, pH, it's negative log, so pH, if it's like an HCl or sulfuric acid, it's really a strong acid, right? So then it's going to be a low pH, right? Like pH 1, right? Maybe pH 1, 2, like in your stomach, pH 2, or maybe to 5, right? So we consider 7 as neutral, right? Neutral pH. But where's temperature in here? So does pH have a temperature effect? So I don't know if I did it here when you were in 350. Did I do it here? I took the water, had a pH meter, had my webcam on the pH meter detector. I took a hot pot. I added it to the water. First, I took that water and divided it up into a hot pot, so that was cold, and added it to the solution measuring the pH. And as we increase temperature, guess what happens? pH drops. But where is that in the equation? It's not there in the equation. That's because they don't teach the full equation.
So pH equals negative log of the hydrogen ion concentration times the activity coefficient. And activity coefficient is a disassociation constant of whatever you're measuring. Alright? So pH has a temperature effect. They don't teach that. That's really a problem. And so you think about that lizard that's sitting out in the desert, right? The nighttime it's cold, the daytime it's warm. Do they have a better buffering capacity then because their body temperature changes? Or the insect compared to another homeotherm that doesn't really change that much? Maybe. Can they handle that better? Do they have better buffering capacity? So these are the kind of things to, you know, you might question, right? That's really quite neat. That's kind of neat. What's the pH range? 0 to 14?
Oh, for like the bodies?
Oh, just the pH of, just out there in the world.
Can it be negative or something?
I don't know. Could it be negative? Anybody think that can you have a negative pH? Negative pH? Positive pH? Yeah, maybe. How do you make a negative pH? What do we normally think of? What you just said. That's really good. It don't work. I'll say crazy things sometimes to you. Correct. Like I almost messed up with hemoglobin saturation. So normally we think pH is 0 to 14 or 1 to 14, right? Everybody heard that. Okay, why do we think that? Because our textbooks give us misconceptions all the time. The Beckman pH meter, by Arnold Beckman, that made the pH meter, his range is only 1 to 14. So everybody thinks pH only exists in that region because that's the pH meter that everybody uses. But you can have pHs in the negative range, negative 2, negative 3. Look at this equation. What's the log base 10 of 10? 1 of 100. The log of 100 is 2. Negative log of a strong acid, 10 molar, HCl, 10 molar sulfuric acid, is going to give you a 1. There's a negative in front of it, negative 1. You can have negative pHs, but the pH meter won't detect it. So you're limited by your measurement technique. So these are things to watch out for, measurement techniques and what their limitations are that they can measure, like the signal to noise ratio, right? Okay, and you can have pHs above 14 as well, but you can't use a pH meter. You've got to do a tritation curve, like those awful things that you have in chemistry class, right? So those are the things that we want to think about too, and how they get these measurements. That's part of understanding the comparative phys. So again, why do we study comparative phys? Because we basically understand a lot about us by looking at other animals. So I make this bet. I made it in 350. No one's got it yet. I did it years ago when I first started, 30 years ago. It's $25, $50, $75, $100, $150. And guess where it is now? It's at $200 cash, tax-free. You pick up your med physiology textbook, all right? Med physiology textbooks, what they teach across the street, and you look at the part about the neuromuscular junction, mammalian neuromuscular junction, and they will show you the shape of an action potential and the presynaptic nerve terminal. So the nerve terminal that innervates the muscle, all right? They will show you the shape of the action potential. I want to find a primary reference for that. You find a primary reference ever recorded in a mammalian preparation at the neuromuscular junction, the shape of the action potential, I'll give you $200. Cash. I've lost bets before. I had paid students. It was on different things. But anyways, what am I trying to make here? Has it ever been recorded in a mammal? As far as I know, never. And we even made bets to the people over in physiology that teach this. And they said, yeah, we teach it. We need to talk about it. But if I keep telling people that they're a squid or the crab or a crayfish, they're going to get confused with mammalian physiology. So we don't talk about it much. We just give the information. So this is what goes on, all right? It's never been recorded. Where has it been recorded? Oh, one of your favorite preparations, which is crayfish. Yes. It's in the crayfish, neuromuscular junction, because the axons are big enough to get an intracellular electrode inside of the axon, so you can actually measure it, okay? Everybody's heard of the sodium-potassium pump, right? 3 sodiums, 2 potassiums, and I gotta shut up here in a minute, right? No, what time do we have? We have until 10:45. Oh, good. Fantastic. Everybody's heard of the sodium-potassium pump. Where was it first measured? How did they actually figure this out? Guess what? Crab muscle. All right, crab muscle. That's where they figured this out. The point I'm making is a lot of our understanding in human physiology is by inference. It hasn't been measured. But by inference, studying other animals on a comparative aspect, we understand how we function. So that's why comparative physiology needs to be really taught.
So the other day, I was swimming in the pool, UK pool. I won't name the clinician that also swims over there once in a while. But we were talking, and I asked him some questions about something else, and he said, oh, he's doing this, and so I asked him these questions about cardiovascular stuff that I wanted to know something about. I said, what do you do about this? And it was about heart regeneration and tissue regeneration, because there's a really good center of muscle biology here on campus, and that with clinicians and athletic trainers and everybody, and we study skeletal muscle in depth, but that we don't really hit cardiac muscle that much, so I wanted to try this relationship. And he said, you know, what do you study? And we talked about fruit flies and crayfish, and he's like, oh, yeah, okay. And, you know, that's okay. And then we got into some details, and he says, well, I really don't know that detail on this about these stem cells and stuff, you know. And it's understandable, because what do you want to do? You want to treat somebody that's sick and make them better or whatever it might be. But at a research place, you hope that we get down to the mechanisms of stuff, too. And he said, well, we're more worried about saving people or helping their health than all this academic stuff. And then we start talking about, well, you know, what are their recordings? Where did this start off? And he heard of Sidney Ringer, you know, which actually Ringer saline, right? Where did he do his first work on stuff? Where do we hear about Sidney Ringer? He actually figured out how the heart beats in frogs, okay, in frogs. And he developed the Sidney Ringer, the saline that we use in IV of humans today, by his work that he did in frogs, okay, and kept the heart beating for a lot. And it was by mistake, actually. He figured out the calcium was needed. It was a mistake. It was a technician mistake. And so he said, yeah, I heard about Sidney Ringer, but I don't know the details. And I'm thinking, well, the details are important, right? So this is interesting. And then I said, so about action potential. What do we teach about action potential? He said, I forgot all this stuff. It must have been recorded in a mouse. I said, oh, God. Okay. It was recorded in a squid. Squid? Why would they do it in a squid? And I wanted to just sink them in the water right then. So this was, you know, and here, you know, he forgot about all this. Maybe he learned it one time and forgot it all. But the squid was fundamental, right? We wouldn't understand anything in neurobiology, really, our electrical conduction, our resting membrane potentials, if that work hadn't started in the squid. And it's because it's a big axon. It was big to do. And you could actually take a squid axon out of the squid, roll the cytoplasm out, the inside stuff, put whatever you want inside, put a wire inside, tie off the ends, and then put it in a dish that's filled with, at that time, they didn't know what kind of saline to use at that time. This is in the 1950s. They put it in seawater, a dish of seawater. And fortunately, the seawater was very much like the squid extracellular fluid and the ion concentrations and osmolarity. And then they studied electrical activity that went down the squid axon. And that was the beginning of understanding, really, bioelectricity at a mechanistic level. I mean, people had found that earlier, Volta and Galvani, with electric shock and making a frog leg twitch back way earlier, but they didn't understand the mechanisms of how that works. So this was the first cellular, really, mechanisms of understanding electrical conduction in cells. And then they, you know, went on from that we'll talk about. So this is the interesting aspects that we have to keep understanding the history of where this comes from, because then we understand the background, and there's still people doing work today in squid because we are beginning to understand more and more about it. What's some recent work that came out of this? It goes back to our pH. Why is it that cells would respond to pH? How do they respond mechanistically? So if you take a cell, and we do this in the lab, we're actually doing this upstairs. It's really fun. You take a cell, you put it in a bath, you stick an electrode in it, and you measure what's called the resting membrane potential, RPG. What's the resting membrane potential, cells? What's the value? It's 35?
Negative 35.
Throw it out there. 55. 55, good. Negative 50, great. Y'all are all right. Textbooks, misconceptions again, all right? Your resting membrane potentials vary depending on the cell that you're measuring. They can vary from minus 90 to minus 20. Your cardiac cells, your pacemaker cells, that don't really have a resting membrane potential, but if you step your SA node that gives rise to the pacemaker potential, it's only like minus 20, and it's a small action potential. You stab the ventricular cells in your heart, the ventricular cells, they're like minus 65, and they get big action potentials. You look at a squid axon, it's minus 90. So some people say minus 90 all the time because the squid axon, right? So resting membrane potentials vary
depending on the cell that you're measuring.
So when you say that, like, we've only looked at this in SWOON exons, so do we only, are we only able to look at, like, how are we able to look at the resting memory potential in, like, human heart cells that we can't see that?
Oh, now they can. At that time, they couldn't. So understanding the very beginning of the history of all this, you started off with the SWOON. That's where I'm talking about. Okay. Now you can culture cells and you can measure them. We step when I worked in my lab at 5 in the morning to get those rabbit cells ready. That's what they were measuring, resting membrane potentials in rabbit cells that were feeding. Can you get a rabbit heart and culture that and have it beating? At that time, I don't know where the data is now. We can look at that. It's really cool. But at that time, I was like, this is so darn cool. In a culture dish, they can keep the rabbit heart beating, the cells beating, for 21 years. They keep changing out the saline, and they were able to keep rabbit cells beating for 21 years in culture. That's crazy. That means the saline was just optimal for everything that they were doing. I was like, blown away by it. So this is what got me more interested in physiology. Where were we? Oh yeah, stabbing a cell and getting resting membrane potential. Let's say it's minus 60. This is what we're doing in millivolts in Drosophila larval neuromuscular junctions in the muscle fiber. And let's drop the pH. Let's go to 5.0. This is normally at 7.1. And what happens, the cell starts to depolarize. So this is depolarization. So minus 60, it might go to minus 40 millivolts. Wow, that's pretty cool. So it depolarizes. Why would it depolarize? Just dropping the pH. Everything else is the same. What's the mechanism? What's the mechanism for the resting membrane potential? What makes cells, this cell at minus 60, another cell at minus 20, and another cell at minus 90?
It's the ions that are on each side of the cell.
Exactly, those ion differences that are across the cell that gives rise to electric potential. And what maintains it? The sodium-potassium pump that was first described in crab muscle, right? And by itself, you got a Nobel Prize for that. And so people understand what maintains that difference in ion. And we're going to go into some detail about it because I want to bring everybody up to speed on all these things. But then, so we can talk about this ion differences. It's mostly sodium-potassium differences, and a lot due to the difference that's allowing the cell to change across the membrane for potassium. Okay, so potassium is really critical. We'll go into more detail about that later. But then why does it change? Why does it go up to minus 40 from minus 60 to minus 40 just by dropping the pH from 7.1 to 5, for example? Did it change the ion concentration differences? Sodium, potassium across the cell, calcium across the cell? But how could you change an ion concentration across the cell to make a change in the electrical potential across the bilipid membrane? That means some ions had to move, right? Some ions had to change, not keep that same differentiation from the outside to the inside. Something had to change. So they found out that there's a particular potassium channel that keeps cells around this minus 60, that it actually closes. This potassium channel, which is called a leak channel, and you might remember this from 350, K2P channels. A K2P channel, it's a two-pore domain of a bilipid, protein that's in the bilipid, and this K2P channel is inhibited by low pH. So if we inhibit it, it starts to depolarize. So that's the mechanism behind it. And now they're finding out, where are K2P channels that are really important? Carotid bodies. And those neurons in the base of your fourth ventricle in your brain. How many K2P channels are there? How many different types are there? They now looked at the human genome. We have 15 different sequences that are possible for K2P channels. Drosophila have 11 different types. Maybe I got those numbers backwards. Different types of K2P channels. Some are super sensitive to pH. Some are not so sensitive to pH. Really interesting, right? Some are sensitive to different pharmacological compounds. Some aren't. So you begin to think about, oh, those are expressed in our carotid bodies. They detect that low pH, change the membrane potential of those cells, and then those cells do what when it changes membrane potential? They release more of these neurotransmitters, actually like acetylcholine, dopamine, and other factors that they're now just beginning to understand more of, and the sensory neuron detects that, and then it fires to the brain. And how do they do that? They can take those out of culture, and they can actually put these neurotransmitters on those sensory neurons and see that their firing rate changes. So you see how it's all coming together, and new things all the time. And this is, they're going back to squid preps. recently to find out what type of K2P channels are in squid preps and how can they handle it. What about those animals that we said that can handle low pH for a long period of time? Do they not express the same levels or same types of K2P channels that other animals sense? So they're not as sensitive? We don't even know in the carotid bodies or in your heart, in that one cell, how many different types of those K2P channels are being expressed and are present in that cell membrane. We know that you have them in your genome, but how are they expressed in every cell? What ratios are they expressed at, right? And that's probably like the same ratios that give rise to different resting membrane potentials of sodium channels and potassium channels that are leaking. Some cells might have more leak channels of potassium. Some cells have fewer leak channels of potassium. That changes their membrane potential. So you get the idea? We really know so little about us and other details until we actually can study in more detail and maybe other animals. And then we can make genetic manipulations and drive it a certain way and then see what happens, right? So that's what happens. So K2P channels, these potassium channels, we'll talk about equilibrium sometime with ions across the membrane, just get everybody at the same level. We overexpress them. We had high school students in the lab that overexpress this K2P channel in Drosophila muscle. And that's the power of Drosophila genetics. You can express in certain cell types, alter their expression levels. So it overexpresses these K2P channels, and our membrane potentials go from minus 60 to like minus 90. And we even had it down to minus 100. Oh, 120 was, I think, the first. Actually, and Maria Petrosava, actually, she's at U of L Med School right now, first class. And she just had a class. I'll just tell you this. She just texted me. It was really cool. We just had a whole lecture on membrane potential, and it was a disaster. This is U of L Med School, sorry. U of L Med School in the physiology department. And she said, they didn't even talk about K2P channels, just told us resting membrane potential. And guess what? They showed us the picture of the action potential. So she sent me a picture of it, right? Which they're not supposed to keep it always, whatever they're teaching. Crazy. Guess what? That action potential, where's that action potential from? That action potential is the shape of a squid action potential, the squid axon. Most neurons in our body do not have that after hyperpolarization that they make you memorize for an MCAT test. Most of our action potentials in our neurons, when they've recorded us from cells in culture and stab them, it comes right back down to resting membrane potential. We don't really have an after hyperpolarization in any of our cells, but squid axon does. So they showed that at the med school and told them this is the shape of the action potential. Never mentioned the squid. Never said that. That's really uncommon. So if they want to go into research later on, they're going to have an epiphany and say, what did I learn in my first year med school physiology class? I didn't learn it right. So there's lots of things happening. She said they never mentioned about K2P channels. They didn't really tell us about different types. They didn't tell us the different diseases that are now being found in people with alternate expression levels of K2P channels. K2P channels go up in cancer cells. So if we understand how that cancer cell might change differently, maybe a pharmacologic agent could hit that particular cell better than other cells. Lots of things that you could think of potentials. So anyways, they overexpress the K2P channel way down to make it more negative levels. Now we can understand what happens if you have an overexpression of this one type of K2P channels. And you could do that in a Drosophila prep. Drosophila preps, I think now it's up to, it used to be 62, 64, I think it's now 65 to 66 human diseases that are now modeled in Drosophila because of the power of genetics and understanding the same mechanism. A Drosophila neuromuscular junction works just like your neuromuscular junctions. You release transmitter, calcium comes in, a vesicle fuses, releases a transmitter. It's the same. So if we look at the mutations that are aspects with that, we might understand more about how to treat those mutations in pharmacologically or genetic manipulations. So it's really cool, the vesicle fusion process and the neuromuscular junction. I think there's three Nobel laureates that were given for this, different things at different times for different aspects of it. Calcium, the proteins that are responsible, how transmitters packaged. Get the idea? Comparative physiology, I'm getting hyped up. Comparative, I want to know more about Drosophila, crayfish, squid, turtles, diving seals, all that kind of stuff.
We can throw humans in there too, right? And there's some really good text. Maybe I can copy some chapters about humans in extreme environments. It was written by a physician, Fong, really cool. He works for NASA, and he studied people that climb up at Mount Everest because why? They want to understand, you know, hypoxia and things like this at these extreme environments and how humans handle it. And so there's some chapters in there that are really exciting, and he just writes a really good book, Extreme Medicine, Extreme Conditions, cold, temperature, altitude, things like that. It gets you thinking about it. And his references are to what? To comparative physiology, understanding how they function so we can understand better about how we function. So it's cool. So our class is going to be discussion, not on me chatting all the time. We're going to cover next time, I guess we have class on Thursday, right? Cellular metabolism, let's talk about that. And I got the PowerPoints up there, I got a PDF up there, I put a new one up there if you downloaded it a long time ago, and I got some little yellow marks in there. So let's think about cellular metabolism, okay? You can join us anytime. I'm gonna get these things from y'all, and we can get going. And I'll try to get everybody's names down. This is my role. All right. Does that sound good? All right, are y'all good with this? Okay, all right. I don't think anybody wants to drop. That's all you need. Almost as bad as 250, right?
Now I'm so excited. It'll be fun.
Okay, it'll be fun.
Hopefully.
All right, I better shut that thing down. In case there's two people.